you don't really need the KGB to tell you that something could go wrong, especially since Dwight Eisenhower had devolved some of the decision-making down to rank-and-file people because of that fear that is depicted in the film that a first strike would somehow make communication with Washington impossible. And so how would we be able to retaliate if the only person who's allowed to give the go-ahead to nuke another country is the president? If the president's incapacitated, how do we retaliate? And the answer was, well, we're going to let some people lower down the food chain make a decision. Hey, maybe like Brigadier Commander Ripper. That's precisely the level at which that kind of decision was actually allowed to be made, which was not general knowledge.
Welcome to the second holiday movie marathon episode of My Nuclear Life. I'm Shelley Lesher. Today, Nathan Ratke and Lee Kuhn from the Uncover Up podcast are back to discuss another one of our favorite movies, Dr. Strangelove. In the last episode, we covered Failsafe and compared some scenes to Dr. Strangelove, but this time, Lee has an interesting thesis to try out on us. There's one more movie to discuss the day after. Since there was so much content, that episode will be posted on our Patreon page. For more information on how to access it and support us and receive some cool swag and bonus content, visit our webpage at mynuclearlife.com.
I suggested that maybe Nikita Khrushchev gets story credit for the plot of Dr. Strangelove, because the plot of the movie mirrors very closely the main ideas of a disinformation campaign. Now, I should just say a few things about disinformation. Nathan and I have done a couple of episodes on our podcast about what is disinformation, how does it work? And basically, it's a form of political warfare that uses forgeries, spies, other types of kind of clandestine operations in order to confuse or distract a political enemy. Now, the problem with talking about historical disinformation campaigns, one that we know have actually happened, the problem with talking about them is it's very difficult to know the effects that they've had. You know, it's not clear, even if we can establish that a disinformation campaign went down, who exactly bought into it or to what extent their mind was changed, in large part also because disinformation, in the way it works, focuses on already existing tensions within a society. The name of the game with disinformation is you try and heighten and exacerbate those tensions, but it's not like you're bringing anything radically new into the universe. Okay, now I have two different sources. I just want to highlight them because they're both very credible. One of them is a scholar named Thomas Ridd, and he has a book called Active Measures, The Secret History of Disinformation and Political Warfare. Thomas Ridd, Active Measures, gave testimony also during the investigation of the 2016 hack of the Democrats. And so he was like, yeah, it was the Russians, and they have a long history, and he's written this book. But my other source for this whole disinformation campaign is actually the CIA themselves. And they wrote a really interesting set of papers called PSYWAR. P-S-Y war, one word, P-S-Y war by forgery. This is a CIA report which gathers together a whole bunch of investigative reports by CIA analysts of these kinds of disinformation campaigns, mostly orchestrated by the KGB and the Soviet Union to kind of distract and dissuade. And the PSYWAR document is available on the web, and it starts on page 39, my part here, with the subtitle, Irresponsible U.S. Atom Pilots. Okay, so how do we get even into the political situation that both Nathan's movie Failsafe and mine take as the kind of accepted starting point, which is this standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States, both essentially at the ready to engage in nuclear war at any moment. I mean, we know, and I'm not going to belabor this point, we know about the history of the Cold War, the end of the Second World War, and the kind of hardening fronts between the quote-unquote West and the Soviet bloc. But just briefly, I'm going to start a very quick timeline in October of 1957, which is when the Soviet Union launches Sputnik. And that is a remarkable event for, I think, kind of a study on U.S. morale in the Cold War, because it certainly had a very large impact on policymakers and civilians who were like, oh my goodness, there's this physical object that embodies a certain advancement in science that we are not duplicating in the West. You know, they've launched a satellite and your amateur ham radio operator could tune into the signal and could hear the beep, beep, beep every however many minutes as this thing flew over the States. And it's a little bit like flipping somebody the bird. Like it's this very unfriendly gesture in a way in the Cold War to say, we're there, we're watching. And of course, by implication, this means we could put cameras in here and look at your missile silos. Or heck, we could theoretically put a bomb on here and drop it on you. What are you going to do about it? I mean, you can't get any planes that go that high. So, you know, when things like this go down, they require a response. And the U.S. responds. Strategic Air Command initiates the very 24/7 nuclear alert response that has the fighters in the sky. And then in November of 1957, the National Security Council suggests that their response time be lessened to between 7 and 22 minutes.
Okay, so you're saying that between 7 and 22 minutes, we would have had a bomber inside Russia to drop a bomb.
Exactly. Able to be at their target to drop a bomb. That's right.
No. 22 minutes scrambled, but I can't imagine in 22 minutes they would have been over.
They're up already. They don't get scrambled.
Yeah, but they couldn't be in Moscow in 22 minutes.
No, but they could respond in that time.
That I could see. They could be on their way in 22 minutes, for sure.
Yeah, so they're ready. They don't need to be scrambled. They're already flying 24/7. So that was the SAC that initiated that. They're like, your bombers need to be up there 24/7. And then later, it's like, but the response time's also got to be really quick. Like, it can't have too much delay, because if it's a first strike, we need to be able to have the thinking time on the ground at the U.S. end in order to be able to initiate the retaliation.
This is so crazy.
And now here's where the Soviet disinformation campaign gets going, that I believe is somehow intrinsically related to the plot of Dr. Strangelove. So the year is still 1957. And on November 22nd, Nikita Khrushchev gives an interview, his actually a second interview, to the American journalist William Randolph Hearst Jr. Okay. And it's in this interview that Khrushchev starts to muse about the possibility of something going wrong because of a mental health crisis by an American bomber. Okay. So here are two quotes from this interview with Nikita Khrushchev. Here, quote number one, Nikita Khrushchev says, "There is always the possibility of a mental blackout when the pilot may take the slightest signal as a sign for action and fly to the target that he's been instructed to fly to." The next quote, "Does this not go to show that in such a case, war may start as a result of sheer misunderstanding, a derangement in the normal psychic state of a person, which may happen to anyone?" Okay, so here we have this idea being brought into the world by the Soviets, at least for the first time. I'm not saying that others hadn't thought of it, but here is a very important person in the Soviet Union sort of signaling to the West, you know, this is a kind of a fear that we have that somebody's going to go rogue and bomb us. Now, the way disinformation campaigns work, and this is, of course, highlighted in the CIA document as well, they are then bolstered by strategically placed forgeries. And the forgeries, by the way, don't come out of directly, like they are not first published in overtly Soviet papers. They tend to use kind of quote-unquote third-party presses, a press in India, a press in East Germany, kind of allied countries that will do a little bit of the dirty work and some of the heavy lifting. And then the Soviets can go back and re-report that information as new information. So now in 1958, there is a forged letter from one of the chief U.S. doctors to then Secretary of Defense Neil McEnroy, okay, in which this doctor claims that there is evidence that 67% of pilots suffer from, and here's the buzzword, psychoneurosis. Yeah? And they put things like, and these are their terms, sexual perversions, alcoholism, gambling addictions, all of these kinds of things are listed as some of the potential problems that many pilots apparently suffer from. Pilots who are also, you know, piloting these bombers that are in the air 24/7. And this is just why history is so awesome sometimes, because it just so happens that the Soviet Union now get a darn piece of good luck from their perspective. Now, this was not part of the operation officially, but you know, when things like this happen, you can make hay with it. Vernon Morgan was a 21-year-old mechanic second class who, on June 13th, 1958, so this is just what, a few months since Nikita Khrushchev gave his warning and the forged letter was published in May 1958, we're now in the summer of 1958, and this second-class mechanic steals a B-45 bomber, manages to get it into the sky, and then crashes it in England. And they're like, see? See what we've been telling you? This stuff ain't safe. Anybody can get a hold of this. And it turns out, and I'll get to this later, at this point, if you had been able to get a hold of a bomber with a bomb on it, there were no safety mechanisms that would prevent you from detonating that thing. So in fact, this was entirely possible. And this was, you know, this was just found gold, this Vernon Morgan incident. The poor guy died, and I don't really know the backstory of what was happening, but, you know, he stole a plane and crashed it. This is like, it's not supposed to be able to happen. Certainly, if you asked me, could you pull something like this off? I'd say, no, you know, that's the plot of like a heist movie or something. There's no way you would be able to get your hands on one of these.
Could I make things a bit more complicated now?
Yes, please.
Because you know who was aware of this Soviet disinformation campaign, of course, was the American government. And I have a RAND Corporation report here that talks about it. Since autumn 1957, there has been a persistent Soviet propaganda campaign about the alleged danger of a nuclear accident as a result of the U.S. defense posture. This campaign is important to the extent that it affects Allied governments and their decisions about American overseas military operations. However, in the same report that they're talking about this Soviet disinformation campaign, they also admit that an individual might intend to cause an unauthorized detonation either because he is a saboteur or because of an abnormal mental state. Traditional security measures are designed to keep saboteurs from atomic weapons. However, you don't want however there. However, neither these security measures nor the ordinary personnel selection procedures can eliminate all individuals who may develop mental disorders that might become dangerous. This is borne out by medical statistics from the services and by case histories of unauthorized acts among mercenary personnel. And then it goes on to the specific dangers of paranoia and secret plotting. So at the same time, they're saying, oh, the Soviets have got this propaganda campaign. In the same report, they say, of course, it's true.
Right. Well, that's that interesting point about the role of disinformation here is that you don't really need the KGB to tell you that something could go wrong, especially if, and this was not general knowledge, this was not generally known at the time, especially since Dwight Eisenhower had devolved some of the decision-making down to like rank and file people because of that fear that is depicted in the film and Failsafe especially, that a first strike would somehow make communication with Washington impossible. And so how would we be able to retaliate if the only person who's allowed to give the go-ahead to nuke another country is the president, if the president's incapacitated, if Washington has been destroyed as a result of a first strike? How do we retaliate? And the answer, which shocked Kennedy when he came into office, was, well, we're going to let some people lower down the food chain make a decision. Hey, maybe like Brigadier Commander Ripper in Dr. Strangelove. Like, that's precisely the level at which that kind of decision was actually allowed to be made, which was not general knowledge.
Yeah, and that's scary because it's not just if Washington's gone, but think about the time. It's also if you couldn't reach the president and a decision had to be made very, very quickly, then those generals could also make the decision. How did we not blow ourselves up?
Yeah, the worrying subplot to all these films is that, you know, this hasn't been resolved yet.
Well, I mean, as the Rand Corporation said, the unauthorized detonation of a nuclear weapon is possible as a result of technical malfunction, human error, a more deliberate human act such as sabotage. It is conceivable that such a detonation will occur within the next decade or so in some weapon system.
Yeah.
1958. I mean, it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
They were just a bit optimistic in their timeline, but the underlying point, I think, is the salient one.
I mean, they did point out that it would certainly be detrimental to United States interests.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, hey, that's detrimental.
What's interesting, though, is that, you know, the Soviet Union's coming out and saying this for everyone to hear, but the Rand Corporation is saying it behind the scenes, right? Like, this wasn't available to the common citizen.
Right. McNamara was totally concerned about this, apparently.
But they're agreeing with each other.
In 1958, and now the Soviet ambassador in London, he gives a speech in which he cites a fake letter where he's got apparently a pilot and their crew who are willing to, quote, drop the bomb the next few days. So they're really ramping it up in terms of sort of scaring the American public. And Thomas Ridd, who I cited earlier as being one of my sources, summarizes this operation by saying, Khrushchev's military psychosis argument made intuitive sense, was hard to counter, and made deploying more nuclear weapons appear reckless. In short, it was perfect raw material for disinformation. It does what it's supposed to do in the sense that the American response now to be like, well, we have to counter the Soviet threat by just building more and more bombs, makes them seem like they're the irrational, unstable, warmongering types that is actually depicted so nicely by Walter Matthau, right? Just one little gem, I'm sorry, but this is just like such beautiful spy versus spy stuff that I had to bring it up. The Americans are sponsoring the publication of a jazz magazine in Germany, which is published in both East and West Germany. But it is essentially a spy magazine that uses jazz as its front. Now, the Soviets know that this jazz magazine called Schlagzeug is actually run secretly by the CIA through various front organizations. Like, the only people who don't know this are the consumers in Germany who are naively buying a jazz magazine, you know, and you know, whatever. Anyway, the Soviets know this is a CIA, small-scale CIA operation. And so the Soviets, in turn, fake this magazine. Like, they create a forgery of this fake magazine that they send out to some subscribers, not all the subscribers, okay? And in this forged magazine, the forgery of a fake CIA front magazine, in this forgery, they have the lyrics of a song called Flying Psychoneurosis, where it's all about like how dropping the bomb is great and fun and, you know, whatever. And there's a nod to the CIA to let the CIA know that the KGB knows that this is a fake magazine because the return address goes to a safe Dropbox in East Germany. And only the CIA would know that. right? So this was like some very high stakes signaling going on, very clandestine, very behind us. And when I read that, I was, I got to bring this up. I got to show you guys because I was so happy.
I have to ask, the Americans didn't trust anything coming out of the Soviet Union. So were they really believing this disinformation campaign coming from the Soviet Union?
So certainly the CIA did not. A lot of people who were already certainly anti-Soviet and anti-communist might have been more suspicious, but disinformation is meant more for the general public. And the general public, we're dealing now in the early 60s, we have a growing sort of, well, it's going to get a lot bigger soon, but we have the beginnings of a peace movement, certainly an anti-bomb movement. This is the connection now to Kubrick. Actually, to your point, Shelley, when Dr. Strangelove was released, one of the big criticisms was, this is just blatant Soviet propaganda. It's just like you lefty Hollywood morons are playing right into their hands. Or even worse, like you guys, like this was just like a front piece produced by the KGB. I mean, the reaction was pretty, in some circles, was to reject it. So yeah, I mean, your point is well taken that if the Soviet ambassador or Nikita Khrushchev says something, but I think it did play on fears that were, you know, emerging. And again, you don't need the KGB to tell you something like this could go wrong, but they're kind of amplifying fears that maybe weren't so publicly expressed until they coalesce it in through articles and stuff like that. And not all of it is coming through obvious Soviet organs. There's Indian newspapers and other newspapers who are, to some extent, unknowingly publishing stuff that seems to implicate, whoa, we've got pilots willing to drop the bomb. We've got doctors who are saying there's a mental health crisis among bombers. But it also does go down to my initial question, which is, how do you measure any of this stuff? It's hard to know. But what we do know is that Stanley Kubrick was obsessed with nuclear war at this point. So he finishes Lolita, which is the previous film to Dr. Strangelove, based, of course, on the book by Nabokov. It comes out in 62. Strangelove comes out in 64. And towards the end of the making of Lolita, Kubrick is totally obsessed with nuclear annihilation, the Cold War, stuff like that, and is reading a huge amount of stuff, including Herman Kahn's book on thermonuclear war. So he's reading a ton of this stuff. Again, I'm not making necessarily a causal argument, but the plot of Dr. Strangelove is the plot of the disinformation campaign, with the slight change that it's not the bomber themselves that has a mental breakdown, but the base commander, Jack D. Ripper. There is so much stuff that I could actually go into with this movie. It is amazing. Irony upon irony and interesting thing upon interesting thing. But one thing I wanted to talk about was, again, not actually the film, but in America, the film opens with a disclaimer that is not part of the European release.
Oh, really?
As far as I know, that's what my research suggests. This was intended for American consumption, this disclaimer. Either way, before the film, even the opening credits begin, there's a quote. It goes as follows. It is the stated position of the U.S. Air Force that their safeguards would prevent the occurrence of such events as are depicted in this film. Furthermore, it should be noted that none of the characters portrayed in this film are meant to represent any real person, living or dead. Second part is less interesting, but also not true, because Curtis LeMay, among others, are obviously in the film. So is Wernher von Braun. So is Kahn. Adlai Stevenson was the basis for Merkin Muffley, the Peter Sellers depiction of the American president at that time. So lots of real people are actually depicted in this film in a satirical way, but that's not the interesting part of that quote. The interesting part is, it is the stated position of the U.S. Air Force that their safeguards would prevent the occurrence of such events as are depicted in this film. And according to the lovely work done by a New Yorker journalist, Eric Schlosser, who wrote at least three articles on just that opening statement.
Well, and he wrote a book, of course.
And he also wrote a book.
Command and Control, which is amazing.
Thank you.
And, by the way, is impossible to get a hold of to come on this podcast.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe now that we've built him up like this, he will be flattered to come on. Well, maybe I'll defer, Shelley, to you a bit because I have not read the book. I've read his articles, which deconstruct the movie really well. But a couple of quotes. So this New Yorker article comes out on January 17th, 2014, which is like 3 days shy of the 50th anniversary of the release of Dr. Strangelove. Eric Schlosser, in his article, states, "We now know that American officers did indeed have the ability to start a Third World War on their own." I mean, that essentially, you can read the rest of his article. It's very interesting. He has one article where he looks at all the files that demonstrate this and kind of gives you a quick summary of what the file says. You have to read it yourself, but gives you the link to the file in case you are actually interested. So he's done some great work. But the situation was, in fact, very much the way Kubrick depicts it in this film. He would not have known this. There was actually a few things that he brings up in this film that are almost prescient. Apparently, when some of the Air Force saw the recreation of the inside of the plane, they were quite shocked. Like, they went pale because he had kind of nailed it. It was way too close for comfort for them. But Kubrick would not have known things like the fact that lower-level officers, not just the president, would have been able to make a game-time decision like this. And as I kept repeating, Kennedy was very shocked by this and was reassured by people like Curtis LeMay and others that, no, there's a, quote, human reliability program, which is one of these psych tests, you know, that you fill out where it's like, would you prefer seaweed or sheep or, I don't know, like these bizarre questions that at the end of which are supposed to tell you whether you're like the kind of person who should be in charge of the nuclear bomb or not. So they were like, don't worry, we've got this under control. We're implementing psych tests and we train our officers and our pilots very well. That was essentially the thing.
I will say that the military officers truly believe in that exam and that they really have this under control. They probably have to, but I'm not sure the rest of us do, but they do.
Well, as a pedagogue, I wonder about these tests as such. Like the Myers-Briggs test, there is so much evidence against that is at all a thing. A lot of people use it, and there's a lot of structural reasons why people use it. I mean, if you actually have to like go through 10,000 resumes and applications, it can bog you down. So why not apply some arbitrary tests that weed out 2/3 or more of the candidates? There's a lot of structural and institutional reasons why people might. The research behind it is very dubious. I mean, it borders a lot on pseudoscience. I would say most of it is pseudoscience. I don't know if I'm exactly qualified enough to say that. I certainly bristle at the use of any kind of personality or intelligence tests. Now, here's a question to both of you. Not having promised not to belabor the actual film as such. Stanley Kubrick wanted to turn this into a straight thriller, nuclear Holocaust thriller, or kind of maybe later it was going to be a drama. It's based on the book Red Alert, which itself is not a comedy. And so the film was going to be much more like Failsafe, which was just a straight, this is what's going to happen kind of warning. And throughout the process of the first couple of drafts of the screenplay, he realizes that this would actually end up being better as a comedy slash comedic satire. It's really more of a satire, I guess, than a straight comedy. And it comes back to an earlier question that you were both talking about in terms of how do you represent something like the destruction of Moscow? And I think a better way than trying to visually represent the destruction of Moscow is something like a phone going to a high-pitched screech. And there's something in the paucity of that representation that allows you to express the magnitude of what's going on. And in the same way, Kubrick starts to feel that you can't actually do this straight, that this is so terrible that in order to express the terror, you need to do this in a comedic way. And that is something that I found actually watching that film was very powerful. It is the only, I think it's with one possible exception that I mentioned in the teaser, that little 10-minute short of this like cute little love story and Nuclear Armageddon. It's the only movie on both our short and long list that gets anywhere close to a comedy. And I think that's kind of remarkable.
Except?
The Atomic Cafe.
It's not a comedy.
It's pretty funny.
No, it's fun. But that's the thing, right? That's the thing.
Yeah, I thought we agreed that Atomic Cafe is a comedy.
Well, okay.
Two of three of us agreed.
Look, okay. Well, if this were a first-year film exam, and you had four choices for Atomic Cafe, one of which was documentary and one of which was comedy, I think you would have to say it's a documentary, which unintentionally is funny because of the absurdity of it.
I'm going to say it's a comedy and then I'm going to contest my mark.
Yeah, you're one of those students. I knew you were one of those students. I'm dealing with you guys all the time. I'm going to say, no, it's absolutely, absolutely a documentary.
I mean, if you look at the back, it is categorized as a documentary, but I respectfully disagree.
Okay. Luckily, we're not actually talking about Atomic Cafe, because we can all agree that Dr. Strangelove is a comedy, right? It's overtly a comedy. It presents itself as a comedy. And we talked off air that that actually impacted the success of Failsafe because it comes out a couple of months later and people walk in thinking it's the same film, you know, thinking it's also a comedy. And they're like, this is a really terrible comedy. But I'm curious about your thoughts on that. Like the role of humor in transmitting or imparting this monumental terror.
I actually think we're probably bad people to ask because I deal with uncomfortable situations using comedy and I deal with bad situations using comedy. So, I mean, this is the way I would deal with situations. I'm one of the people that really enjoy the murder podcast because I deal with uncomfortable situations with comedy.
But I think you make an interesting point there, right? Which is that this is the way we actually deal with it to a large extent.
And it's not disrespect. It's just the way I process being uncomfortable.
It's a gallows humor.
Yes.
And it's a gallows with like 10 million nooses on it.
But does it work better? Because you guys did the straight version. You guys did the just like, here's the nuclear end to humanity film. Does it work better to bring home that message when you do it in the form of a joke? Like, do you become more scared, as I think I did? See, this is maybe a bit of an awkward example, but with Nathan's film, I dislike Walter Matthau's character so much that I want nuclear war to happen just for the resolution in the film.
That is quite an overreaction. That is, wow.
That's what that guy made me feel. Whereas, even though I was cheering for the bombers, or I found myself cheering for it. I was also, you know, I felt like the characters were very sympathetic. Sellers as the president, I mean, that's got to be one of the funniest moments in cinema ever, is when he has this one-sided conversation with the Soviet Premier Dmitry, who he's woken up, who's a bit drunk, and, you know, he's trying to placate him, that I'm also upset, Dmitry. It's just brilliant.
Doesn't he say something like, well, you can't be more upset than I am, Dmitry?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's agree that we're both upset. When we ask this question, we're asking the question, how do we comprehend the incomprehensible? Because ultimately, a nuclear exchange would be something so far past imagining, so far past our ability, our human minds to even grasp, that it's ungraspable. We touched on this before when we said, why are there so many nuclear movies about giant bugs? You need something as absurd as the giant bug to get a handle on something as incomprehensible as nuclear annihilation. Like, that's why Gojira is so effective, because it is ridiculous. It is absurd, but it's an absurdity that can maybe try to match the scale of the absurdity that we're actually trying to deal with.
I think that was Kubrick's position. I think he arrives at that through this evolution of the various screenplays, where you depict the horror of the undepictable by kind of turning it into a joke and turning the decision makers and their process of thinking into a joke as well. And what's not funny, of course, is that that's actually how a lot of it went down. A lot goes wrong because a kind of a breakdown in communication. The Soviets have this doomsday device that they're going to reveal on Monday, you know, but this all goes down a few days before they've had a chance to reveal their doomsday device. Now, the doomsday device is much like the device in Failsafe, where it sort of is automatically triggered when there's kind of a conclusive threat detected. And again, this is in order to be able to take the human beings out of the equation. It means then, even if you were theoretically to murder everybody in the Soviet Union, you're still not safe. You know, Americans back at home, still not safe because we've got this automated system. And the Dr. Strangelove character, who's based in part on Wernher von Braun and Herman Kahn, this kind of amalgamation of these two guys, he says to the Soviet ambassador, it's no good if you don't tell anybody that you have it, you know? Now, here's the scary part of this. The Soviets go on, probably not having watched this film, to actually create this doomsday device. And it's called the perimeter system, or dead hand. And it is precisely a bunch of sensors and computers, just like the doomsday device, that's supposed to kind of go off automatically. And guess what? They don't tell anybody about it. The Americans, the West, does not learn about it until long after the Cold War is over. And apparently, it's still operational.
What?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I defer here to you, Shelley. But that's what my initial research into dead hand reveals. So, as you were saying, we're not out of the woods. At least now we know they have a doomsday device. I guess that's the upside.
Remember, run towards the bomb.
The other thing I thought was kind of funny through doing my research in this, there's something called PALs. These are basically their security devices on bombs that didn't exist earlier. And the PALs refers to permissive action link. And these are, like, for laymen like me and Nathan, are locks on the bombs, so that you can't just get one and blow things up, which at the time of making of Dr. Strangelove was not ubiquitous. In fact, most bombs did not have these, and the Air Force really resisted it. Back to your point earlier, Shelley, about how Curtis LeMay and others really trusted the training of their officers to kind of deal with any of this stuff. Eventually, though, because of course what I didn't even mention in the formation of Kubrick's project is that the Cuban Missile Crisis happens between the filming of Lolita and the release of Dr. Strangelove. So you actually have a real world event that kind of, you know, again, brings us close to a hot war. But eventually these PALs, these locks, are made standard on all the bombs. And the Air Force is so upset with this. This comes from Schlesinger, I think. He only has circumstantial evidence for this, but apparently he's heard it from more than one source. The Air Force had their code on their security system across the board at all missile silos, 000000000. That was the code. So, you know, again, that metaphorical flipping the bird, it's like, ah, we got this, it's going to be fine. We don't need any bureaucrats telling us how to deal with the bombs. So I didn't talk much about the film. I could say much, much more. There's so many beautiful ironies in the film.
I don't even know that we need to go into the day after.
Well, no, but now we need to know what happens after that very phallic image at the end of Major Kong kind of
writing the missile down.
As always, thank you for listening. What do you think? Does Khrushchev deserve a writing credit on Dr. Strangelove? Let us know on Twitter at @NuclearLifePod. Thanks to Nathan and Lee. Make sure you listen to their podcast on conspiracy theories, The Uncover Up. To learn more about our podcast, visit us at MyNuclearLife.com, ask us a question, or send us a comment at MyNuclearLife@ProtonMail.com. To help us out, leave us a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and tell a friend to listen. Until next time, I'm Shelley Lesher, and this has been another episode of My Nuclear Life.